Well, good morning. My name is Chris. I'm a pastor and elder here at Resonate. Glad you're with us this morning. We are just going to dive right in. We've been walking through Genesis 1 through 11. We are in chapter 4, just left the Garden of Eden and are picking up the story of Cain and Abel. So we're going to read through starting chapter 4, verse 1. I'll read through 16, and then there'll be a time for us to sort of collectively have some sort of observations, to ask some questions. There'll be some mics available. Sometimes they're just observational things to point out. Sometimes it's the curious things that you just really want to ask a question about that doesn't maybe make sense, or you've always just wondered about, or something maybe you haven't noticed in the text before. So let's start at verse 1. The man was intimate with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. She said, I have had a male child with the Lord's help. She also gave birth to his brother Abel. Now Abel became a shepherd of flocks, and Cain worked the ground. In the course of time, Cain presented some of the land's produce as an offering to the Lord. And Abel also presented an offering, some of the firstborn of his flock and their fat portions. The Lord had regard for Abel and his offerings, but he did not have regard for Cain and his offering. Cain was furious, and he looked despondent. And then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you furious, and why do you look despondent? If you do what is right, won't you be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. Its desire is for you, and you must rule over it." Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he said. "Am I my brother's guardian?" Then he said, "What have you done? Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed, alienated from the ground that opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood you have shed. If you work the ground, it will never again give you its yield. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." But Cain answered the Lord, "My punishment is too great to bear. Since you are banishing me today from the face of the earth, and I must hide from your presence and become a restless wanderer on the earth, whoever finds me will kill me." Then the Lord replied to him, "In that case, whoever kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times older." And he placed a mark on Cain so that whoever found him would not kill him. Then Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. No questions at all, I am sure. The last service had plenty. We had to shut it down. But anything that initially sparked some questioning for you? Yeah, Steve.
It seems like there might have been a command that's not in the text with how the brothers responded. And I've always been curious about that. Like, I've inferred that God commanded to bring an animal instead of a crop. But
sure. The difficulty, yeah, is that as you read the text, God never said to do anything. Yeah. And so what is the issue at hand? And that we will parse out in sermon, but... yeah, it's a great observation to be like, God didn't tell them what to bring or even to bring anything at all in the story so far. So on the flip side, both of those offerings are perfectly legitimate Levitical offerings in the book of Leviticus, not just animals, but plants. Yeah.
It feels like a escalating shame spiral. Like God just says, "Oh, do what's right." And then that somehow triggers him to murder. And then he gives his kind of admonition, and then Cain's like in desperation, like, "I'm wiped out."
Yeah.
So, I don't know. That just stood out.
No, it's a great observation. And there's definitely some amplification of what happened in Genesis 1 through 3, or really Genesis 3, into Genesis 4. And the level's higher, but even the shame still feels higher. Of we pointed out in the first service, God's still having a conversation with Cain and Abel outside the garden. So there's some sense of presence, but it's Cain that seems to go, I need to leave your presence. There's some sense of shame in sort of that. God's like, I'm going to make you a wanderer and I'm going to curse the ground, but it's Cain that's like, I'm going to flee your presence. So there's some interesting sort of shame play out in that. Yeah.
How does one simply rule over sin?
Over it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been a good route to go with the sermon. I'm not going there today. There are ways we've talked about in the past of like practical things, but probably the big piece we'll deal with actually on that front is the question of like, will we continue to trust the story that God tells it versus probably ways that our heart will have some inclinations? So we'll talk about that a little bit. We won't deal with some like practicals of like read your Bible more, pray or stuff like that. But I think there's a bigger question that this text is trying to ask about how we view God and why that affects sin and how it can have an effect on us. Yeah.
Who are all these other people that will kill it? I mean, I was waiting for someone else to ask.
This is where I started some controversy in the first service. And if you're new with us, sorry, you're probably not going to pay attention to the sermon after I say this. If you've been around for a few of these sermons, you kind of know I have some nuance to how I think about this. And hear me. Theologians disagree with me. You don't have to land in the same camp I do. I look at Genesis 1 and 2 very differently. I think Genesis 1 is the creation of humanity. We get Ish and Isha, man and woman, and they're told to be fruitful and multiply. And I think Genesis 1 happens. I think humans are fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Genesis itself and the Torah itself is not really concerned about death and the afterlife very much. So all the questions we want to bring about like, well, did people die? What happened to their souls? All that kind of stuff. It's just not very Torah-ish. There's a reason why the Sadducees are like, we don't believe in the resurrection because there's just not much of a conversation about it. So Genesis 1 happens, fills the earth. I think the paradigm we will get through God's people is God always having a selective representative of himself from amongst the larger community to be sort of his representation, his priests. He will even call Israel that. So he does it with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the forefathers. He'll do it with Israel and say, you're going to be a nation of priests. You're going to be selected out. You're the firstborn amongst all the nations, all this kind of stuff. So I think Genesis 2 is God creating temple, a very specific temple space, and designating two priestly sort of individuals in that space to go be, to also be fruitful and multiply, and to tend and keep, they get priestly words for them, to tend and keep the garden, and to allow access to the tree of life to the rest of humanity. That should be their goal. They fail, obviously, in that. And so when Cain and Abel are kicked out of that sacred space and their role changes a bit and stuff like that, I think there's already a humanity that exists that's probably maybe violent and maybe different than God's chosen people within the garden. And so in my interpretation, it works. But I understand that there's holes in that. There's mystery to that. There's some gaps. There's some things you got to deal with, what Paul says about death and life and Adam. But there's ways I would deal with that I don't want to unpack right now. But I think that's who we're dealing with. And that's why there is a population outside the garden, because we don't have language yet. We will get language that Adam and Eve also have more children and stuff like that. But we don't have that yet when Cain's like, there's going to be a bunch of people out there. So that's my take. You could disagree with me. If you want to dive in more to your scriptures because of what I just said, great. That's my win for you. Oh yeah, sorry. Wait for the mic.
I'm living
we'll just take
out
a couple
my
more.
Ricky
I don't wanna...
Lake dream of passing the mic, okay? If you don't know who that is.
This is actually Alex's question, but he didn't want to ask it. So
he's here today. He can ask this.
I know, he's right here. I told him he should. He wanted to know what the mark was.
Great. It's a wonderful question. Guess what? I don't know. I have no clue. We are never told what the mark is. But here's something I'll say. I'll try not to repeat it and waste our time later. Sometimes we think of the mark on Cain as like the scarlet letter, like it's this mark of shame. But in the context, it's the exact opposite. God's like, hey, I don't want violence to come to you. I want protection for you, Cain. And so I'm going to give you this mark in order to protect you from punishment from others. Like, yes, there's punishment in the ground. There's some curses that you are going to have to experience. But the mark becomes this sort of like wonderful graciousness of God in the midst of his judgment as well, rather than you're carrying this mark so everybody knows what you did. That's just not the scenario. We have no clue. I don't know what it looked like. So, sorry. I don't want to speak where the Bible doesn't. Yeah, Phil.
There's this parallelism of the language, at least in the English, between the curse and the curse against sin. I'm just wondering if that's overwritten, or is it actually the same language and it's supposed to have some sort of
Yeah, there's a ton of parallels. Actually, let's just do that slide. Colton, if you don't mind jumping ahead to the parallel slide. So Genesis 3 and Genesis 4 have a ton of familiarities. And so Genesis 2 and 3, you get the two trees, you get the option of choice for the individuals, and then Cain and Abel have this sort of option of, Cain, if you choose good, if you choose to do what's good, this is the outcome if you choose sin. Same thing. The responsibilities, so the tending and keeping of the garden, Cain will be like, am I my brother's guardian in the CSV, but it's the same word for keep. So it's actually a parallel there. Am I supposed to be this keeper? The tempter is a serpent, and then as we read in this one, it's sort of like this devourer, this thing that's waiting to pounce. It has a very animalistic kind of description. The questions all happen again. Where are you? Cain, why are you downcast? Or where's your brother? The sort of engagement kind of questions there. The desires sort of are presented as distorted. The word sort of desire actually exists in both. So Eve looks at the fruit. It's desirable. It's good to the eyes, all that kind of stuff. Cain's like, sin has a desire for you. So the language is continuing over. There's a lot of Hebraic usage. Sin is sort of this mistrust, this disobedience kind of in the garden. And then outside the garden, it turns into murder. So there's an amplification we see in the story. The land is cursed, and then here it takes on the blood of Abel, and the ground actually ends up getting cursed with Cain in some ways. There's a repetition of the curse. The exile, both are east, and then even further east. One's sort of east, but probably still in Eden. Eden's a region, not just the garden. And then one's like where the drums are now. And so it gets sent further east outside the garden. This is the garden. And then protection. One, they get clothed on their way out, and then once again, as I said, Cain gets marked. They're sort of a protectionist. And there's other pieces in there too, but there's a lot of intentional language and parallels that are going on, as if to say sin is having its effect and amplifying as it's getting worse. And then we'll see Lamech next week be like, I'm the most violent person around. And so we'll see all this kind of continue to play out. But yeah. There's a lot of that, which is beautiful. It's good to catch it. In English, sometimes we miss some things. So like Eden and Nod become this really interesting play on words that we don't catch because of English. But yeah, great. You saved me a slide to teach on later. Anything else? We should probably wrap up there, actually. That's it? Show's over. Great. Yeah. I'll try my best to skip over those things that we just covered. But the story ends last week, and we're east sort of the garden. We've left the garden, the space between what was meant to be and what is now experienced. And we all sort of live in that as well, the sort of how things are meant to be and the feeling of how things should be versus the reality. We work hard, the ground pushes back against us. We love deeply, but relationships still crack. We long for peace, but anxiety is under everything sometimes. We believe in God's goodness, but some days it's hard to feel it. And it's all over the place. For some, it's the quiet exhaustion of juggling school and work and family, the sense that we can never rest without falling behind. So for some, it's comparison. We scroll through pictures and videos. We hear someone's success story, and we wonder why God has given them favor. Did God forget me? For parents, maybe the pressure to hold on to everything together, career, marriage, kids, bills, everything else, all while pretending you're okay. For students, it's the constant question, am I enough? Are my grades enough? Are the activities I'm involved in enough? Is my friend group, am I enough for them? Maybe those struggling with work or housing right now, it's the feeling that maybe the world sort of tilted against you in some ways, that God is silent. And it's a perception sometimes that we're on our own. And that ache can easily turn into something else. It can start breeding things like fear or rivalry or scarcity. We believe that perhaps there's just not enough opportunity. There's not enough favor. There's not enough blessing to go around. And the play out of that is sometimes we start measuring life by what we can grab, what we can achieve. We start resenting those whose lives look easier or fuller or more blessed. And perhaps inherent in that is the same lie that goes back to chapter 4, that God's favor is limited, that somebody else may get my share. We should note the story today that even in exile, it starts with the blessing again, right? They leave the garden, and the first thing that happens is not death, but life. They have a child. The man was intimate with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And so they have this new life in their arms. Broken world outside the garden, but blessing hasn't stopped. Exile is not the end of the story. It just changes the setting of the story. And it's the same question I think we all wrestle with. Can God still be trusted outside the garden? Is God still enough? When life feels uncertain and unfair, can we still trust that this God is good? When we're outside of the ideal sort of situation that the garden would have presented for us with, can we trust the story? Can we trust the truth, what God says about himself, what he says about us? Well, let's start with the names of the kids. So we did Cain and Abel, and then the whole chapter is bookmarked with in the Hebrew, it's very much a parallel to the opening sentence with Seth. And so it says, she said, I have had a male child with the Lord's help. She also gave birth to his brother Abel. Now Abel became a shepherd of flocks, and Cain worked the ground. And then verse 25, if you want to jump ahead, it's Adam was intimate with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth. For she said, God has given me another offspring in the place of Abel since Cain killed him. So start with Cain. The CSB is doing some interesting interpretive choices here. But more literally, the word there is that I have acquired. So if you read some of the other translations, they do a really good job at this. I have acquired, I have gotten a man. There's no child in the text. It just says an ish. Alongside or with the Lord's help or besides the Lord or like God did. As if she is saying, look, God made a man and now I have done that. I have acquired for myself a man. And perhaps there's even a striving tone, because we're going to see a very different response with Seth. A striving tone of accomplishment. A Cain is marked by, I acquired this. The instinct to get, to secure. I have secured a man for myself. And then we get Abel. Abel's name simply means like vapor or breath, like a mist. His life will be short, very here today, gone tomorrow. Weirdly enough, of the three sons, his name will be the one to continue more than the other two ever will. We'll even see in Hebrews the reference to Abel's name still speaking, the blood on the ground still speaking. And then Seth is the third child that will be told in this chapter. Seth means appointed or granted. God, she's sort of saying, God has Sethed me a child, appointed me a child. And it's a very different phrasing, a very different posture, I would argue. Not acquired or gotten or grasped that, but God has appointed me this. And if Genesis is going to teach us anything, names matter a lot. They're literary setups. That in the outside of the garden, what we are starting to see is what was just promised. There's going to be two seeds. There's going to be seed of the serpent, seed of Eve. Now, all of them are biologically the seed of Eve, but we're already starting to see two very divergent paths. We have Cain, who's acquisition, striving, grasping, and Seth, who's appointment, or grace, or reception. Two very different lines. Then Abel, sort of this fragile voice in between, pointing to the reality, I think, that's larger than himself. So life outside the garden continues. Exile is not abandonment. God still gives life, but the posture is of how we receive life seems to already be diverging. Striving, maybe even fragility in Abel, or grace in Seth. And with those names hanging in air, I think the question is, what happens when these brothers approach God in worship? So they come, in the course of time, Cain presented some of the land's produce as an offering to the Lord. Abel presented an offering, firstborn of his flock, fat portions. The Lord had regard for Abel and his offerings, but he did not have regard for Cain and his offerings. Cain was furious and looked despondent. So this is the first human act, sort of a worship, to occur east of the garden. And as we said before, there's no commands, there's no instructions. God didn't say, here's what I demand of you, make sure you do this. It seems to be just a response in worship to the God who gives life. And probably, and there's some scholars that go this route, the door, if it says your door in the text, there's no your, it's just the door. The door is probably actually the entrance to the garden, because we'll see in the temple and the tabernacle where you bring your offerings is to the curtain, and ultimately through the curtain to what is called in the tabernacle in the temple, the door. And so likely they're coming there to do this worship, which will matter in a moment. Cain's a farmer. He brings fruit of the ground. Abel is a shepherd, brings the fat portions from his firstborn. And just as a hint for something in the future, which one of those is a city job? We look at both as rural jobs, right? But one of those requires you to probably stay more stationary and require probably some extra workers. And that's farmers. So historically, really, really ancient-wise, we think of farmers now as very rural, but farmers would have been all the people that would surround the city. Shepherders are super nomadic and didn't require the cities as much. That will play out in the book of Genesis a ton, because God seems to have a preference towards shepherds and have a lot of things to say about cities. So we'll see that. So Cain brings some of the fruit of the soil. The language is sort of simple and vague. We don't get a lot of details. Abel brings fat portions, firstborn of his flock, detailed, costly, prioritized. Now, some will make a big deal about the offerings. I don't. I think that Abel's offering is better. I have no problem with that. I think the language there is in that case. But does God ever say Cain's offering is bad or wrong? We never get that language. Actually, he says that he regarded, and regarded as he gazed at. He gazed at Abel's offering, and he didn't gaze at Cain's offering. That's all we get. As the story continues, does God really say anything about the offering of Cain or how it could have been better or the quality of it or anything like that? We don't get any of that language. He doesn't even bring up the offering in his engagement. If this were about the ritual rules and what would be best, God would probably explain what Cain did wrong, but he doesn't do that. It's just not in the text. And perhaps more the question is Cain's perception of the Lord's favor. Maybe that's the real drive of the story. Because the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but he did not have regard for Cain and his offering. So as I said, one drew God's gaze and the other one didn't. God's acceptance of Abel wasn't a rejection of Cain. The text is actually really careful to not include anything negative in it. God simply pays attention to one in that moment and not the other. It's almost like my own children. I'll sometimes like, someone will hand in a test and be like, oh, you did amazing, you're so smart. And then the other one will be like, aren't I smart too? And I'm like, no, I was just talking over here. It's okay. Like, you don't need the affirmation all the time. Like, yes, you're smart too. And I think that's exactly what's playing out in the story. Cain's whole work here depends on things he can't control. Cain very much understands rain, sunshine, soil. He knows he needs God. He has the job that would do that. And if Cain would trust who God is, that God's world is good, that there's enough to go around, that the Creator still loves and sustains his creation, then Cain can rest. He can work. He can worship without fear. All of that would be true. But sin is crouching at the door, the place of worship, the place where he would perceive God. And if he stops trusting, if Cain stops trusting in this moment, what happens is fear creeps in. Everything starts changing. Suddenly there's maybe a sense that God's favor is limited. If he gives Abel the favor, then it's not mine. Blessing maybe starts feeling like competition. That if God looks at Abel's gift and looks at Cain's and he doesn't see God's abundance in that. So if that's the case, if he sees maybe God's favor, God's blessing, God's attention as limited, how then will he start to see Abel? It's like a threat, right? A competition. His brother becomes a rival who might take what little love or favor that there might be, and that creates this sort of threat in them. It's what fear does. It turns people into competitors, and it turns God into a miser, and I think that's what's happening to Cain here. And we all do this. Somehow, somebody else gets the promotion, and we perhaps assume God's favor has passed us by, or a friend's marriage is just thriving, and we interpret that as evidence maybe as God forgotten ours, or another family grows, and we assume that God just has less room for us. And the lie I think Cain is buying into is that God's love, approval, favor is scarce or rationed. While the truth is, outside the gardens, God's posture hasn't actually shifted. His love's not diminished by blessing another. And will Cain actually believe that? And hear me, this is why I think the Bible is like the greatest book ever. I mean, besides that, it's so focused on Jesus, but like all these things speak to our core heart issues and questions that we all navigate day in and day out. And so where do we feel Cain's envy in our own life? Who do we compare ourselves against? What makes us silently say things like, God, why them and not me? Right? Like, I have pastor friends who's baptizing hundreds, and their church is growing. They have all sorts of influence. They've got all this amazing stuff happening. And I'll hear their stories, and I'll see their stuff, and I'll be like, man, that seems awesome. I want that. I wish I was baptizing people every Sunday. That'd be so cool. It'd be exciting. We'd clap. We'd celebrate. I don't know how much time we'd have for the service, but it'd be awesome. And then I watch that, and I'm kind of jealous. And then my mind starts doing things like, yeah, but I know that guy, and like, he doesn't totally preach the whole gospel. It's like Jesus light, and the bar is really low. Are they actually making disciples? Are they just baptizing people? All that kind of stuff goes into my head. And I'm doing what Cain does. And I'm starting to, instead of celebrating God's generosity and know that his generosity is just as good for me as it is for them, I'm starting to play that game where I'm almost making the other the enemy. And the real test of worship doesn't seem to be the offering you bring, but the God you see. Is he the God of scarcity and withholding, or God whose love is never in short supply? Because Cain and Abel both worship. Yes, God shows favor or attention to Abel's offering, and Cain reads it as something to be angry about, as if God's approval was not enough to go around. But God isn't done. He steps in here, just like he does in the garden, and engages. He says, the Lord said to Cain, why are you furious? Why are you despondent? If you do what's right, won't you be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. So we get the first kind of picture of anger in Scripture. And God doesn't come in to angry Cain and be like, do not do that. This is an inappropriate response, Cain. This is not how he comes in. He's not coming in harsh, but just with a question. Hey, why are you angry? Why are you downcast? Which I think mirrors Eden. Where are you? What have you done? He doesn't accuse. He invites Cain to reflect, I think, on his moment. And when anger arises, God's first word isn't get out of my presence. It's why? Let's talk about why. And what would change in us if we actually think God engages us in our emotional angers, our emotional highs, our emotional lows, all that, with invitation sometimes rather than dismissal. And he says, if you do what is yatab, if you do right, won't you say yes, won't you be accepted? So if you do what is right, what is good, it's related to the word tov, which we heard in Genesis 1, everything was good or very good. Will you not say off this? Will you not lift your face up? Will there not be vindication? Like, you're okay, Cain. God isn't closing the door. He's saying nothing has actually shifted. I think that's his argument here. Trust the story, Cain. Choose good and you'll be lifted up. There's still something possible right now, Cain, before everything gets worse. But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at the door. And this desire for you, and you must rule over. And sin's personified as a predator, sort of here, desire to rule, sort of the echo of Genesis 3:16 about desire to be for your husband. All that language is reiterated. And humanity is created to rule over the beasts. So there's language about ruling over these sort of beasts. Just as much as they were to rule over the serpent, Cain must now rule the beasts of sin. And I think that's what it means to be human in this moment, to trust God's definition of good and not to surrender to the animal impulse. We even talked about the naming of the animals, why Adam had to go through this whole process, and why the serpent seems the most humanish animal ever created. It's very much that. For humans to recognize we are not the beasts. We don't just give in to all of our cravings. So our anger leads to a certain kind of craving and we do not give in to it. So Cain, with clenched fists, facing the dirt, jealousy burning in his chest, and then it feels like God kneels down. Cain, why are you angry? Nothing has changed. My love has not shifted. You can still be lifted up. Don't let the beast master you, Cain, in this moment. You were made for more than this. That's what the invitation feels like in the moment. That God's heart for every one of us when we stand on the threshold of anger and resentment and envy is very much that. Sin's crouching. And will our view of God affect how that plays out in our homes, in our politics, in our churches, in our relationships. The lie of scarcity that fuels anger, rivalry, violence. But God says, trust the story. My favor is not scarce. My love is not rationed. Master the beast. Don't let it master you. And maybe all of us have places where sin might be crouching at the door right now in our anger at someone. In maybe our scrolling envy, in our bitterness at being overlooked. What would it look like to trust God's abundance instead of letting the beast have you? Because God hasn't changed. That's the lesson at hand. His posture is steady. His love is abundant. The environment has changed, leaving the garden, but God hasn't. And Cain is still invited to trust, to do good, to be lifted up. But will he listen? And we see that he does not. Sin is intensified as the story goes. So let's get to the field and the ground. Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. And while they were in the field, Cain attacks his brother Abel and kills him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where's your brother Abel? I don't know. Am I my brother's guardian or keeper? Then he said, what have you done? Your brother's blood cries out from the ground. So now you are cursed, alienated from the ground that opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood that you have shed. If you work the ground, it will never again give you a yield. You'll be restless wander on the earth. So Cain invites Abel out to the field, which is ironically his place of work, the soil that he is intending to cultivate, and the ground, which is meant to produce life out of the garden, becomes the setting of death. The word brother is repeated 7 times. It's very much a focus, I think, in the repetition, that this isn't just human violence, it's a rupture of family, and being on the ground is a rupture of vocation, and then the cursed ground, sort of the creation itself, in vocation, all of this, all in the text. Where's your brother? Which feels like Eden. Where are you? He says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper or guardian? What is the answer to that question? Yes. Yes. And the whole rest of the Old Testament and New Testament is to teach us that we are our brother's keepers and sister's keepers, right? The entire of the Old Testament is to answer that question in the affirmative. To love your neighbor as yourself means I am my brother and my neighbor's keeper, even to the point of my enemy. Paul will say all of the law is summed up in that. And then we see the cry of the ground. What have you done? Brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So the soil, which had already been cursed because of Adam, now bears witness to human violence. And what Cain thought he was doing in hiding, creation itself saw, like the ground of Genesis, has always been a sort of silent character. We'll see it multiple times, formed in it, blessed and to work it, exiled, and now raises its voice in protest. It's like a random force. It's Tom Bombadil, if you're a big Lord of the Rings fan. It's like this weird nature force. It's so nerdy for me to do that. I get that. But creation itself knows when something is not as it should be. And Romans 8 has that echo. Creation groans. It's waiting for redemption. There's something about humanity, sin, earth's experience of that, which can get into a whole sermon about earth care. And one day I hope to do that, but that's not where I'm at. We're not going to unpack that totally yet. But there's such a beautiful connection between the ground and our brokenness and how they're interrelated. So now you're cursed, alienated from the ground that opened its mouth. If you work the ground, it will never again give you the yield. So Cain polluted the soil will resist him. Cain took life, and now his rootedness in his life is now going to sort of be a wanderer. And Adam's sin made work harder. Cain's sin makes his own work impossible. And that continues. And Cain thought, nobody would see it. Same way sometimes our play out of our sin, we're like, no one's going to see it. It doesn't matter. And we do the same thing. Let me skip a few of these. Let's get to verse 13. But Cain answered the Lord, my punishment is too great to bear, since you are banishing me today from the face of the earth, and I must hide from your presence and become a restless wanderer on the earth. Whoever finds me will kill me. So Cain has this beautiful opportunity to be repentant, to say, I sinned against my brother and against you, God, all that. He doesn't do anything. Cain shows no sense of confession. he sort of focuses still on himself as a response here, not on the brother he killed, not on the God he betrayed. He grieves the consequences, but not the sin. Which once again, when we do sin in hiding, and then it finally comes out, often we grieve the consequences that we get caught in rather than the sin itself, which is really the invitation from God. God is so gracious, he just wants you to come in and grieve the sin itself. His words, Cain's words, are about fear and exile, separation, exposure. Cain fears being alone in a world where now he feels unsafe. And the Lord replied to him, but we see the character of God again. In that case, whoever kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over. And he placed a mark on Cain so that whoever found him would not kill him. So it said, this is not shame. This is graciousness. It limits vengeance. It stops the cycle of retribution before it begins. And from the start, God is finding ways to restrain human violence, even when humans probably will not do that. It's the first sign. And these signs in scriptures are often sort of a mix of good and bad things, right? The rainbow. God judged the earth. He set a covenant, right? Blood on the doorpost. God's rejecting Egypt, shows mercy for Israel. Circumcision. There's a covenant of obligation and of grace. And baptism, it's the death of Jesus and the resurrection of to new life. And these markers, these things that we have, are these beautiful moments where God's mercy will always accompany some moments of justice, of his response to sin. And then Cain went out to the Lord's presence, and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. In Hebrew, Nod and Eden are re-jumbled letters. So it's super fascinating. It's almost like the anti-Eden. And then he settles there, which God told him, don't settle, you're going to be a wanderer. And then he's like, I'm going to start a city with my wife. And so he decides to do that. But humanity drifts further east towards essentially Babylon from where Eden is thought to be. Yet even there, God's mercy goes with him as he wanders. And the story does not end with annihilation, but with a mark. A small, stubborn symbol that even in exile, God still protects. Divine mercy is not the absence of consequences, because there are certainly consequences for Cain, but a refusal to let consequences be the final word. And so let me wrap up. The story of Cain and Abel isn't just ancient history. It's a mirror. It's meant to be a mirror for us. Every heart stands at the same crossroads at some point. Will we trust God's goodness or let fear rule over us? Do we believe that God is enough, or do we turn to others into rivals? And east of Eden, we still bring offerings, right? Our work, our worship, our lives, all the things that Paul kind of tells us to bring as our worship, our service to the Lord. And maybe we bring them hoping they're good enough, hoping that they give meaning and purpose and accomplishment. But Genesis reminds us the question was never about the offering, but always about the trust. And fear will say God's favor is limited. God's graciousness is limited. God's attention is limited. And faith says God's goodness never runs out. And the beauty is that, I mean, we'll leave it mostly here, but there is a better word. Hebrews will talk about Jesus' blood speaking a better word than the one of Abel. And there was a lot of thought when Jesus came. Some of the Son of God language is thought of tied into Abel. That the Son of God was going to come. The vengeance that Abel, they've been waiting for, was finally going to happen. That God was finally going to set things right, and we're going to need a warrior to go do that, and it's going to be bloodshed, there's going to be battles, and he's going to have his victory. And that's why Jesus' sort of nature of forgiveness blew people's minds. But that's the kind of God we have. Jesus' blood doesn't cry out for vengeance, it cries out for forgiveness. And the cross is the mark of mercy, the end of rivalry, the end of fear. His blood doesn't cry out against us, but for us. By faith, the victory over sin in our redemption. East of Eden is where we all live, but it's also where grace meets us in Christ. Where God still comes asking, where are you? And he invites us into the story again to live a life of repentance and confession, that to simply come back and come back and come back and come back. And where are we living out of fear instead of trust? Who have we turned into a rival because of envy and scarcity? And what would it look like to trust right here in whatever your East of Eden looks like day in and day out, and to see God as still good? So I invite Sarah up to lead us in a time of reflection and communion, and then we'll continue to worship through song.